Japanese and Hanukkah. And we haven't spoken that much about Hanukkah yet, and we're going to speak a little bit about it now. What I think really has come together is we've understood now that the Maccabees were not necessarily the freedom of religion-loving freedom fighters that we make them out to be. Should I smile?
No, because I'm not getting you.
Get a book and put it under.
One of my favorite things about the Maccabees in, you know, jest is always that people say, you know, if you ask kids what Hanukkah's about, they'll say religious freedom. And, you know, I always want to say to them, yeah, if you followed their religion, right? There wasn't about religious freedom. It was about their freedom to be able to follow their religion, which included precluding other people from living their religious observance in the way they saw fit. They were obviously, as the story with Matiyahu shows us, particularly outraged. One of the rabbis, by the way, and when I say the rabbis, these are the people that we're going to see are going to wind up ruling Jewish life after 70 CE, not BCE, which we're going to get to in a little bit. They saw the Maccabees not necessarily incorrectly as usurpers to the priests. Right. Remember, we have the world is not divided into rabbis yet. It soon is going to be divided, I mean, into rabbis and priests and the common folks. The truth is about Hanukkah that it has both secular / militaristic foundations to it and religious foundations to it. You can't say it's one or the other. It's obviously both. I mean, Hanukkah itself, anybody know what the word means? Hanukkah means rededication. Or dedication, actually. It was about the rededicating the temple. And of course, we know it's really all about military victories as well. The rise of Hanukkah in the Jewish popular story, Mark was asking me, I think, a little bit before, but in one of the questions, was when did Hanukkah start becoming popular? You know, Hanukkah was a minor holiday for centuries, not years, for centuries. And the fact is, we know it's a minor holiday because there's nothing religious associated with it other than the insertion into the Amidah of a prayer about the miracles. The same exact, almost the same exact prayer that's inserted in there for Purim as well. It's Al HaNisim, on these miracles. There's no religious prohibitions like there would be on Sukkot or something else. You can drive, you can cook, you can do whatever you want. There's no special religious service for Hanukkah. Right now, some synagogues might read certain scrolls or something like, or read certain stories or have traditions, but that's just their traditions. It's nothing in particular that's religiously mandated by the rabbis. Hanukkah, of course, then it became popular because of the Zionists. And we're going to talk in a few minutes about why the Zionists made it such a popular holiday. The other reason, of course, that it became popular in the United States was because it was seen as in parallel to Christmas. It was a way of maintaining Jewish identity, so it really rises in importance well beyond what is mandated for Hanukkah. But there's no doubt that Hanukkah and the Maccabees are vastly popular in Jewish popular culture today. I wrote down a couple things. The quadrennial sports event, the Maccabiah Games, are held in Israel every 4 years, and the Maccabi Games are held here every year. Baltimore is one of the host cities, usually, for that. They're youth sports games. There's a network of soccer and basketball teams in Israel called Maccabi, or Maccabi.
Maccabi Tel Aviv.
Right, Maccabi Tel Aviv. And they're always the best, most well-funded, very popular. And I mentioned earlier, there's a tasty little beer in Israel called Maccabi. Or I think I mentioned that. It's called or Maccabi beer. And everybody who goes to Israel, and I certainly did this the first time I was in Israel, gets a thing of Maccabi and brings it home because it's just neat, because it's an original product of the Jewish state. But it's named Maccabi or Maccabi. Vastly, vastly popular. So I guess I want to take a few minutes now. We've kind of been doing this informally, but I want you guys to hash it out. I want you to take in groups of twos or threes, take 5 minutes or so, and I want you to discuss how we should view the Maccabees today.
Just ask a question before we do that.
Yeah.
How did it get started as a holiday? And how did the story become one that would be,
something
people would want to celebrate?
So it's some of the stories are woven through the Talmud, like I talked about. Yom Nicanor is one of them. It really didn't become a popular celebration, though, until modern times. I don't know, I can't mandate and say this is when it happened, but I'm certain that the rabbis at one point said, here's the holiday, and this is the day that we do it on. Because remember, what it's really about for the rabbis is remembering the miracle of the menorah, of the Hanukkah lights. That's in the Talmud as well. So I assume it says in Talmud, but I haven't seen that it says on the, I don't know what day of Cheshvan it is. It's the month of Cheshvan. Do you know what day?
I believe it's 25th, Kislev.
Kislev, I'm sorry. I was looking at a different calendar today for something else.
In the
month of Kislev, on this day, you celebrate the miracle of Hanukkah and you light lamps to observe that. But that's all they do. They talk about the miracle. It doesn't become a big deal, right? It's not a fast day, for example. You don't fast the day before on behalf of the people who were murdered, you know, by the Greeks or anything like that. So anyway,
The menorah in the temple. Mm-hmm. The Hanukkah menorah has 4 and 4 in the Shamas.
Right. The menorah in the temple would have been 7.
So in other words, the menorah from Hanukkah is a different menorah than the temple.
Because it lasted 8 days.
Don't they call it the Chanukiah?
The Chanukiah is what it's called. Yeah, menorah is a Yiddish word for a Chanukiah in Hebrew. So it's the same thing, just different languages.
Somewhere later on, with the rabbis, this Chanukiah was started, invented, or formed.
Correct. Correct. The rabbis did that. They invented stuff.
I remember Rabbi Loeb always spoke about Hanukkah, and he spoke about, you know, the candles and stuff, and he always said that the rabbis poo-pooed Hanukkah, just what we were talking about, because
right.
It was such a militaristic killing people and stuff, and the rabbis at that time didn't want the Jews to start an uprising. The rabbis wanted to keep them sort of quiet.
Excellent. You're right on target. The word menorah in Hebrew means lamp. In Yiddish, it means Chanukiah or Hanukkah menorah, so it's a little confusing. So anyway, take about 5 minutes and talk amongst yourselves about how we should view the Maccabees today. Are they role models? And should we change the way we view Hanukkah? We haven't come out and said that one way or another. So, amongst yourself.
Give up latkes?
Presents?
This is what Sirius Adonai does. He turns your thinking around.
I mean, how to look at it today?
That's a good point.
But I think that in the past,
it's a unifying force.
I'll come around and listen to what you have to
say.
Conversations. All right, so let's go around the room and see what we came up with. Your charge was, how should we view the Maccabees today? Are they role models? Or should we change the way we view Hanukkah? So what did you guys come up with?
You got sidetracked.
Well, you were talking about some Jewish history stuff.
We were.
So how did the Amalekites come up?
Someone in the group made reference to the fact that we thought that the Jews weren't supposed to go to war. So
okay.
That's how the came up.
Fair enough. The answer to that, just so everybody here, is the question was, are Jews supposed to go to war? And the answer was, there are times when they're commanded to go to war in self-defense, and sometimes you're allowed to take the offensive to make sure that you don't get slaughtered in the interim. But there's all types of prohibitions about that. When you go to war, for example, you have to allow your enemy an escape route. You're not supposed to surround your enemy on 4 sides, but only on 3, and you're not supposed to tear down or burn down the trees, because that's an offense to God as well. So there's all types of prohibitions about that. And there's prohibitions about who gets to go to war. You know, somebody who's recently been married is not allowed to go to war, and so on and so on. And all that comes from the Torah.
The Torah have a job.
Sorry, we didn't answer the question.
That's okay. You did a little Jewish history. That's good. Goodbye, us.
We kind of talked about in a rabbinic tradition that it's multidimensional. There are a lot of different lessons, and they don't have to be mutually exclusive. And there are different lessons for different age groups and different
ages.
Contemporary
okay.
issues. And
okay. So we should kind of censor it for the younger kids, basically.
Yeah, but in today's world, some of these other issues we talked about are important to consider.
Right. Right. Okay. Fair enough. So all right, it's a multi-year approach to Jewish history. And David, or same group?
Oh, we were a group.
We were a group.
Okay.
I think what you said is probably very true. Is that there are layers. And I think it's easier to be more civilized when your existence is not at risk. But I think that, and if you can survive and survive someone else's surviving, I think that's probably the better way, no question about it. But the way it was always explained when I was growing up, it was a question of they were losing their Jewish identity. They were having, it wasn't like what the Greeks were doing in a sense was forbidding Jewish practice. So it was a question of either revolt and try to survive, or if you let the Greeks put statues in the synagogues or in the temple, if you could no longer be circumcised, if you could no longer do various and sundry things, you could, you know, then I think it was, I would think it was perceived as being extinction. It was a way of, it was a kind of a holocaust.
Existential.
Maybe more passively.
Intermarriage has been referred to in those words. Yeah. That is a holocaust.
Yeah, I'm in favor of Hanukkah. And I grew up, and it was a fun holiday.
Right.
My daddy
right.
used to dress up as Mr. Hanukkah. You know,
what's Mr. Hanukkah look like?
Actually, looks a lot like St. Nick, except he didn't wear a red suit.
Like a
would have. My father had a big white beard made of rolls of cotton.
That's
and we got
terrific.
Presents. But again, it was balanced off against, you know, the non-Jews or the Christians, because since we live in a Christian country, and I don't say that pejoratively.
Yeah.
But certainly it was the majority. It was that way 60, 70 years ago, even more so. The non-Jewish kids were singing Christmas carols, and they were getting Christmas presents and those kinds of things. And so as not to feel like by being Jewish we were being punished, we were being deprived, we knew that we had our own holidays. It was different, but that it was okay that they had their holidays, because in our own way we had our holidays, and again, it was fun.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, every group has to have its own myths, and in fact, at least, you know, I grew up at a time when before the birth of Israel, when there weren't many situations in history where there were Jewish heroes. Jews could revolt, and Jews could
no Moshe Dayan. Right?
No, well that's right, and so that part may not be necessary now, but I think it's a myth for us, and at least in the U.S., the Christian world sees it as a much more important holiday than Jews do.
So, well, let me ask you then: do you think that we should teach children, or maybe even just teenagers, what the things that we talked about tonight, or is that just something that should come in adulthood?
I think probably come in adulthood.
Okay.
It depends on the ability of the recipient to comprehend maybe the nuances and things.
Yeah.
But I think he's right. I mean, I think Marshall is right. I think everybody has to have heroes. They have to have someone they can look up to.
Right.
George Washington was a great general. You know, well, we have our own Jewish general, and he saved the nation.
And I can tell you that I can suspend my, academic beliefs, and I thoroughly enjoy lighting the Hanukkah candle. I thoroughly enjoy singing those blessings.
And playing with the dreidel.
Yeah.
That's a fun
song. I have an app so that if you're traveling,
during Hanukkah. You can open up the app and it sings this. It does the bracha, and every day, there's another candle.
That's cute. Aaron?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't think you're going to be able to hide things from young people anymore. I mean, I think we all are educated in a certain way, and I think there's going to be a totally different experience.
And they're all looking, watching, playing Call of Duty when they're 10 years old.
Well, it's not that. They're going to be curious, they're going to question, and they're going to Google. You know,
right,
and they're going
right.
to find out the truth.
It's interesting. This truth has never been hidden, but it's never been popularized. It's just kind of interesting, and what remains to see, be seen what happens to it.
You know, Peter Beinart said something like, the essence of most Jewish holidays are they tried to kill us, we won, let's eat.
Okay. Right.
And this reminds me of that, too, because it cuts the story off short with the substance that lies behind it.
In
order to celebrate it as a holiday.
And in some regards, it's a shame. In all regards, it's a shame because there are clearly lessons to be drawn from the complete story as well, which aren't necessarily bad ones. Yeah.
So first of all, I love Hanukkah because my father had a business on the Lower East Side of New York, and he was a toy wholesaler. Mm-hmm. I wish the lamp went for 12 nights. But what we were talking about was we made reference to the Holocaust, where it was the feeling. And there were exceptions, the Belsky brothers and
Bielski,
and Orso Ghetto, but it was sort of felt like the Jews were lambs and they just went to slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that what we sort of came up with was that it's important to have heroes, it's important to have somebody like the Maccabees, and that's what we need to teach our kids.
Okay, and it's interesting because, you know, when you talk about the Holocaust, and we're going to do a whole class on the Jewish community in Israel and the Holocaust, but the Zionist conception basically was the Jews went like sheep to slaughter. You know, that was it. It's obviously a lot more complicated than that.
Make your comment about the idea.
And we also know it's not true.
Right, so it's obviously much more complicated.
And Mitchell made a good point.
Well, just that, you know, the militaristic is not, it's not in fashion anymore. But Israel, without a military, there wouldn't be an Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, unfortunately, Israel is a militaristic country. Everybody serves in the army in Israel. But it's not out of the desire to do it, it's out of the necessity. And I just think we are so lucky, everybody sitting in this room, American Jews in the late 20th century, early 21st century, that, you know, we're not singled out by anybody. We're easily assimilated into our society. We don't need anybody to look out for our security, the welfare of our security. And this may be one of the few times in the history of Judaism where we can actually be in a place that where our security as being Jews is safe.
Right, okay. Right. America has been said, it's an aberration in Jewish history.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Did someone else want to say something?
Greeks and the Swiss kids all serve in the army.
Yeah, so they're
right.
Not the only ones.
And of course, it's obviously modern Zionist contemporary thought, but not everyone in Israel serves in the army, right? The Haredim don't serve in the army,
yeah.
And the Arabs don't serve in the army. So you're talking up
to
30% of the population.
They can serve in the army.
The Arabs?
The Jews can. No,
the Arabs can, but they don't.
The Jews can.
Jews do.
You're speaking, there's a small minority set called the Druze, which is about 2%
of
the population.
There may be some Bedouins.
There are Bedouin trackers
in the
Arabs.
Yeah.
Michelle?
But again, the
there actually, lately, in the last couple of years, have been a couple of news stories. So there are some pretty well-known Arab ones they go home and they hide their uniform when they're home, kind of thing. But yeah, so it's
these are a handful of people, right?
It's a handful.
But also, the Israeli army, the Israelis have said, we don't want to put the Arabs in a situation where they may have to fight their brethren. You know, and if they're...
Well,
that's not the real reason, I don't think.
An attempt at.
Yeah, that's not the real reason. The real reason is they're afraid they're going to be a fifth column.
Yes, yeah.
That's, you know, it's a security-conscious country, and that's the reasoning behind it.
Live in a tough neighborhood.
Oh, absolutely. I don't say it's
but
necessarily
they do trust
the
Bedouin.
I think they should do national service, but that's a whole other conversation.
Well, they're
but
trying
they're,
to do
they're
that.
They're instituting.
It's not so easy.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think they should force it.
Right. Well, you know what those rabbis have to think about that.
Right. Yeah, those rabbis are tough.
They're
all right. Powerful. All right. So some good conversation. By the way, after the Maccabees fell from power, there wasn't going to be an independent Jewish state until 1948. That's why it's important to focus on them right now, even though there were a couple of rebellions that we're going to see. Jewish nationalism itself was always going to continue, but it was going to be suppressed by the rabbis. There will always be elements of it, but it was be suppressed. Now, I want to spend a few moments talking about the role of the Maccabees in Hanukkah for the Zionists. Why is it that the secular Zionists so admire the Maccabees? Why is it that the secular Zionists so admire the Maccabees? Any thoughts?
They were in favor of creating a Jewish nation and some elements.
And this was, right.
You know, sort of aggressively or through military means, creating the state.
Exactly. They identified, it's paradox, because the Maccabees were religious zealots, and the secular Zionists were zealots against religion, in every sense of the word. In fact, they literally were trying to create a new sense of Jewish religion through a Zionist secularism, which would maintain a Jewish identity in a new way. But clearly, the Maccabees were the last Jewish state, so there was a definite link there, and they saw themselves, like the Maccabees, as being forced into defending the homeland. That they had, and they were going against tremendous odds, and that they were zealots for what they believed in. The secular Zionists did not compromise either. And we're going to see, as we get more into the course, the fights amongst the Zionists themselves were fights without bloodshed, but they were vitriolic in terms of the language that they would use against one another and some of the things that they would try to do to one another. Let me give you a couple examples of how the early Zionists used Hanukkah. By the way, of course, they went against imperialistic rulers as well. So the Zionists saw first the Turks and then the British as imperialistic rulers. There was an early Zionist poem named Saul Chernikovsky. I'm not going to write his name because it has about every letter in the alphabet. He was an early Zionist poem, and he wrote a poem about the ancient sage Akiva, who we're going to hear from in a little bit. Akiva was asked, "Where are they, the holy ones? Where are the Maccabees?" And the reply, "All Israel is holy. You are the Maccabee," meaning you, the Zionist, is the Maccabee. And poetry was very important for the early Zionists. In fact, there's some beautiful poetry that we're going to be able to read in translation. The Hanukkah prayers are very interesting, and the Zionists did sing the Hanukkah prayers while lighting the menorah, because the Hanukkah, and this is the paradox, because the Hanukkah prayers speak about God's power. You know, they all start with Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu. You know, thank you, God, for making this miracle and making that miracle. So there was a little bit of paradox in there. Anyone know the popular song Mi Yimelel? It's Mi Yimelel Ugvurot Yisrael Koyimine. It's a very popular Hanukkah song, particularly in Israel. Menashe Ravina was another poet. What he did there was he rewrote Psalm 106. Psalm 106 says, "Who can recount the mighty acts of the Lord?" But his poem, his song, says, "Who can recount the heroism of Israel?" So they layered Jewish belief, religious belief, they poured on top of it the secular belief. And you can hear the echo of it throughout the early Zionist rhetoric, which is kind of fascinating. All right, now we've spent a lot of time on the Maccabees. It's time to move on to the Romans. The Romans, if the Greeks were strong in their rule of the world, the Romans were even stronger. The Romans ruled even more land. In 63 BCE, a guy named Pompey comes to Palestine. Conquers it and establishes Roman rule, 60 BCE. They're going to stay in the land for a long, long time, for hundreds of years. The Romans did something interesting. They appointed a Jewish king and priests, which got the Zionists increasingly upset. Now, it was interesting that they did this because the Maccabees were the ones who originally started appointing kings and priests, right? And so nothing else was going on other than it was non-Jews doing it. There was more Hellenizing, or I guess you'll call it Romanizing, going on in terms of, you know, people wanting to lift weights and be strong and read certain things and learn other languages. The Romans had an interesting attitude toward the Jews. they were puzzled about why the Jews refused to eat pork, but they loved pork. They couldn't understand why anyone in the world wouldn't want to eat pork. Some Jews feel that way today. They also didn't understand why the Jews circumcised infant boys, because why would you mutilate the human body if it's supposed to be a beautiful thing? And that's their inheritance of the Greek ideal as well. They couldn't understand why there was no image of God in the temple. If this is your God and this is your beautiful temple to God, why don't you have a statue, a picture, a bust, something to show your God? They thought Shabbat was a sign of laziness. They weren't hostile, they were just curious. They had different understandings. You know, the Romans saw the state, for example, as a place to unite people for the common good. How did the Jews view the state? Any thoughts? How did the Jews view the state? The state was meant for one thing, right? To serve God, right? The state centered in Jerusalem, which centered on the temple, and what you did is you observed God's law. You forced Torah law. In fact, in the Jewish state, anybody know when there's the only time that there's a public assembly? Remember, the Romans loved their assemblies, right? They were gathering in all types of coliseums and legislatures and all, what have you.
The three holidays.
Three holidays. You come to Jerusalem
and offer sacrifice.
When the Torah is read publicly. That's it. Those are the only times. All religious based. Nothing has to do with the well doings or the runnings of the state. Because after all, this is a monarchy. You know, it's not a republic, which early Rome was. Even the empire, the Caesar was subject to the rules of the Senate, in certain ways. The Jews were different. The Romans learned they wouldn't compromise. Something that Alexander learned too, but they allowed them to do it. The Romans tolerated the Jews. Because what did the Jews have to do for the Romans?
We know
pay taxes. That's it. That's the theme of the ancient world. Pay taxes and behave yourself, basically. You know, don't revolt, but that's not going to hold too long. The Jews responded in an interesting way. They offered sacrifices to the emperor in the temple, which of course made the zealots very, very unhappy, because there were always still a group of zealots around. And that's somewhat remarkable if you think about it. The Jews were willing to be subservient to the extent that they would make a sacrifice on behalf of Caesar in the temple. Things would unfortunately begin to degenerate. The zealots would gain upper hand. By degenerate, I mean that taxes became increasingly difficult, burdensome for the population. By the year 66, the Great Revolt is going to start. This is one of the two great revolts in Jewish history. This is 66 CE now. Of course, it's going to start in Jerusalem. The next one's going to be, and we're going to get to it, but I'll write it here, 132 to 135. So they're going to be generations apart. What happened, basically, was there were small groups rebelling for years. There would be small groups in the countryside, hiding out in caves. They would attack groups of Roman soldiers, small groups periodically. It's kind of nipping at the heels of the enemy, as they call them. This is going to be called one of the great tragedies of Jewish history, this first revolt. The Romans said in 39, the Emperor Caligula, who's made famous by a movie in the late 70s, said there should be a statue of him in every temple in the empire. Well, remember what I said about my professor, that you can do anything you want to the Jews, just don't mess with their temples. The Jews alone refused throughout the empire. Everyone else said, sure, why not? We've got a statue of our God. It doesn't really matter. Well, they were only saved from a horrible fate with the untimely death of Caligula. He was assassinated, just as was Julius Caesar, very violently, when he was at a public event. All of this, nonetheless, gave rise to Jewish radicals known as the Kanaim. Kanaim or zealots. It gave them more impetus, more people began joining the zealots. Let me move over to this side. The Roman soldiers continued to hassle the Jews. They once burned the Torah in the temple. That's about as offensive as you're going to get to the Jewish people. Well, by 66, a revolt breaks out. A Roman procurator, which is another way of saying a Roman high-ranking officer, named Florus, steals money from the temple. Another no-no. Eleazar, the priest at the temple, persuaded his fellow priests in response to cease sacrifices for the emperor. Well, you can imagine how this made the Romans feel. They weren't so happy. You know, if there's anything that they were beholden to, it was the emperor. And the Jews begin to riot. War is at hand. And guess what? They do really well. This is very surprising for... This is a culture... Yeah?
How many Jewish people are there?
We believe there's more than... You know, maybe there's upwards to 2 million Jews living in the land of Israel at this time. We can't confirm that. Now, we're going to later see that Josephus, who's one of the most extant sources we have from this period, says that 1 million Jews were killed in the Great Rebellion. We know that hundreds of thousands were killed. I'm comfortable with saying that. Whether or not it was a million, obviously, you know, just like in the Torah says to the 100th generation. Well, that's a way of saying forever. So a way of saying a million might mean just a whole heck of a lot. Because obviously they didn't count. The Jews wiped out the Roman garrison in Jerusalem. The Romans had a garrison stationed at the Temple Mount. They had built a special barracks for it because this was the center of the city. This is where the officials were. The Temple Mount, if you know from the Temple Mount today, is a very large area. And at various times in history, it was even larger. The Temple Mount, it's interesting, by the way, you know, it's really on filled-in hills. If you took away the Temple Mount, you would have a rocky terrain there. Just like you have on the outskirts of Jerusalem, not far from there. It's kind of hard to imagine it that way, but that's indeed the case. The Romans sent a larger force from Syria, and the Jews routed that too. This was somewhat remarkable. The Jews became bold, and some would say too bold. Their ranks, however, in terms of people willing to fight the Romans, kept growing because people kept seeing success. Well, the Romans returned with 60,000 heavily armed, high-level troops. And what the Roman troops did, and I talked about it a little while ago in the first half, is the Romans would come at you and just keep coming at you. And they would just send for more reinforcements. They would siege you for years. It didn't really matter. Some of you have been to Masada. We'll talk about that hopefully tonight as well. You know there's the snake path on one side of the mountain, but there's the Roman ramp on the other side. Well, that's literally a ramp that the Romans took a year or so to build. And it just didn't matter to them. You can see the remains of their encampment there. They just stayed and stayed and stayed.
But part of the success of the Roman Empire was the reputation that they were unbeatable.
Right.
So if you had a revolution or you had an uprising, you had to crush it. Because if
exactly.
they didn't, then the word would spread, hey, you can take them on.
Every single little revolt was serious. Every single little thing for them was serious. You're absolutely correct. But we do know something. It's really fascinating. The Jews were really good fighters.
They had nothing to lose.
Well,
it's like today's world. They couldn't afford to lose.
Right. It's not just that they couldn't afford to lose. Well, they did lose, ultimately. But they were really good fighters, which is really surprising that they were able to take on the Roman legions at this point. Because these weren't insignificant troops. They were highly trained troops. And if the Romans did anything, they trained their troops well. All right. The Romans returned with the 60,000 troops. They hit the Galilee first. It's estimated that 100,000 Jews were killed there and sold into slavery. Right. So the Romans, if you picture this, are coming down. Let's see. Now you're going to see how bad an artist I really am. So the Romans are coming down from Syria into the Galilee. They're taking their time here. They're wiping people out. Then they're making their way down to Jerusalem. And they're, of course, wiping out villages along the way because the villages are supporting the revolution as well. Jerusalem, however, is holding out. Jerusalem, remember, is a walled city, right? Or at least sections of it are a walled city. Not the whole thing. People are living in villages outside of it as well. One of the things that happened is that the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem did not come to the aid of the Jews in the Galilee. All right, they stayed put here. Because why did they not come to the aid of the Jews in the Galilee? Any thoughts? Anyone?
I'm sure they would have been
they were outnumbered.
They would have been wiped out. Yeah. They were smart. That's why. They knew it wasn't smart to go against the Romans. So guess what? The survivors come to Jerusalem, and they kill all the moderate leaders. All right? And they take over Jerusalem, and they begin manning the barricades, as it were, defending Jerusalem, which of course means having people on the outskirts trying to see what's going on and sentries and what have you. So once again, just like with the Maccabees, we have somewhat of a Jewish civil war going on here. This is a theme that's repeating itself throughout Jewish history. The Romans set siege, and inside the Jews are busy having their civil war. This is where the Talmud gives us the famous example, by the way, of something called Sinat Chinam, or baseless hatred. Anybody ever heard of that? Baseless hatred? Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, one guy is invited to a wedding and another guy is not invited. This is just before the siege. Another guy is not invited to the wedding, or no, one guy's hosting a wedding or a party, and another guy is not invited to the party. And the guy who is not invited to the party basically says, you know, I'll pay for half of the party. Just let me come. I need to be seen at this party. And the guy says, no, I don't want you here. He says, I'll pay for the whole party. Let me come to your party. He says, no, I don't want to be seen. So he goes and he tells the Roman sentry or the Roman procurator officer who, you know, again, this is just before the revolt gets too crazy. And the Roman officer somehow says, well, wait a minute here. You know, there seems to be a problem here. And he says something like they're not offering a sacrifice to Caesar and what have you. And the Roman officer goes in and has everybody killed. I'm changing the details a little bit because I don't have it in front of me. And that's what's called baseless hatred. And Judaism always talks about baseless hatred. That's a theme in particular on Tisha B'Av. And they say that the temple was destroyed because of baseless hatred, that led to the revolts. All right. The Romans were going to win this war. There's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about that the Romans are going to win this war. Jewish infighting speeds it up, you know, which is another interesting message from the time. Now, I mentioned Josephus a while ago. Josephus was a general for the Jews up in the Galilee. And Josephus basically lost those battles, fled, and what he did is he became a traitor. He became a Benedict Arnold, the Benedict Arnold of ancient Jewish history. He turned himself into the Romans, and he said to Vespasian, the leader of the Roman troops, you're going to become emperor, and I can, you know, help you. Let me tell you how the Jews are aligning themselves and what have you, and their fortifications. Josephus, in his books, tells us that he did this because he knew that the Jews were going to lose no matter what, and he was trying to save Jewish lives. And he always paints himself as the hero of the Jewish people for doing this. What Josephus has done, however, is given us the best, the most complete description of what happened in those times. He wrote several books. One was called The War of the Jews, and another one was called Antiquities, which he basically traced Jewish history throughout them. They're phenomenally detailed books. They're difficult to read because they're phenomenally detailed. They're not written with a theme in mind. They're written with the concept of getting every single detail possible, as in every officer and every battle and every town and what have you. So let me read you what Josephus had to say about the siege. Thus did the miseries of Jerusalem grow worse and worse every day, and the seditious were still more irritated by the calamities they were under, even while the famine preyed upon themselves, after it had preyed upon the people. There was a shortage of food, obviously. There was a famine going on here. People were going stir crazy. They couldn't get out. Their food supplies were reduced to almost nothing. And indeed, the multitude of carcasses that lay in heaps, one upon another, was a horrible sight, and produced a pestilent stench, which was a hindrance to those that would make sallies out of the city and fight the enemy. People were dropping dead from plagues or famine, and what have you. But as those were to go in battle array, who had been already used to 10,000 murderers, and must tread upon those dead bodies as they marched along, so were not they terrified, nor did they pity men as they marched over them, nor did they deem this affront offered to the deceased to be any ill omen to themselves, but as they had their right hands already polluted with the murders of their own countrymen. Remember, they had killed the moderate leaders in Jerusalem. And in that condition ran out to fight with foreigners, they seemed to me to have cast a reproach upon God himself, as if he were too slow in punishing them. So Josephus is saying they defied God by what they were doing. For the war was not now gone on with as if they had any hope of victory, for they glorified after a brutish manner in that despair of deliverance they were already in. So that's Josephus' picture of the siege of Jerusalem, a particularly difficult time. However, there was one person who was in Jerusalem at this time who saw a different path. His name was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Anybody ever hear of him? Anybody know anything about him?
Holy Spirit.
Michelle, was there anything?
If I recall the story, he faked his own death, had his disciples, including, I think, a nephew who was sort of a turncoat, carry him out of the city. When he got out of the city, they took him to the general, and he told the general that he would become Emperor Titus. And the emperor
Vespasian. Titus was his son. Vespasian.
Vespasian. And he said that, and he asked for a place where he'd go with his disciples to learn, and they were allowed to do so.
Right. Very good. So to give a little more detail, Yochanan ben Zakkai was a great religious leader. He was what we would call one of the early rabbis. Did you have your hand up? Doing a little symphony action there. he was one of the early rabbis. He was a great teacher. He was a moderate who wasn't killed because he was so beloved by so many that it would have been impolitic to kill him. Yet he had no power whatsoever. He and his disciples concocted a plan. They would take his body and they would wrap it in a shroud, a burial shroud. They would actually put meat underneath the shroud so that it would smell putrid, so it would be like a dead body. And they would smuggle him out of the city. As they began to take him out of the city, the Sicarii, another word for the zealot. Yeah, I did say the Sicarii. The Sicarii, or the Sicarim, wanted to take a sword and poke it through his body to make sure that he was dead. And his disciples said, how dare you defile our great master? You can't defile our great master. And the respect for him was so great that they let them take him out of the city, because they were going to bury him, because you don't bury people in the city, obviously. They knew something about sanitary conditions in the ancient times, just not enough. What they did, however, when they got him out of the city and out of sight, is they unwrapped him, they took the meat off him, and they took him to Vespasian, the Roman head of the army, and he said to Vespasian, you know, my lord or whatever, I'm going to tell you how to, siege Jerusalem. Or actually, no, he didn't tell him how to siege Jerusalem. That was another myth that has been debunked. He said, I have brought people out of the city. I can smuggle more people out of the city. It'll weaken the city. And my lord, you are going to become emperor. So what happens is shortly after this, so Vespasian's in the camp, Yochanan ben Zakkai is in the camp, and Vespasian learns from a messenger that the emperor in Jerusalem, Rome, has died, thank you, and he has been elected by the Senate as emperor. And Vespasian goes to Yochanan ben Zakkai, and he tells him this, and Yochanan ben Zakkai says, I want three things. He says, I want Yavne. Yavne is a small town. It's still there in southern Israel today. He says, I want a physician to treat Rabbi Tzadok, who is, the legend says, fasted 40 years to stave off the destruction of Jerusalem. And I want the descendants of Rabban Gamliel, or Rabbi Gamliel, who are descended from the Davidic dynasty, or King David. Why would they want the descendants of King David to live?
Messiah.
The Messiah will be a descendant from the line of King David. That's correct. And Mashiach, we say Mashiach ben David in the Amidah and Shacharit on Shabbat morning and every morning. So Vespasian is very impressed and he grants all of his wishes. It is actually now 9 o'clock. I could go on because I have a lot more. What we've done tonight is we have covered primarily the Greek and the Roman periods. We're not quite done with the Roman period. Next week, I'm going to finish up the Roman period, and then I'm going to give a really long detailed lecture on Hobsbawm. No, I'm just kidding. We're going to talk about nationalism, and we're going to talk about other Zions. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.